From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A serious uptick in violence in Ukraine, with the month-long buildup of attacks by Kiev's forces against civilians in Donetsk and elsewhere in the east, taking an increasing number of civilian casualties, and now being met by resistance from local self-defense forces. But at Thursday's State Department press conference in Washington, Department spokesperson Heather Nauert laid the blame not on Kiev, but on Russia.
The United States says it wants to condemn the latest violence in eastern Ukraine. The last 24 hours were considered the deadliest one-day period in 2017. In this time period, 8 Ukrainian soldiers have now been killed, including 5 deaths in an attack which appears to have been initiated by Russian-led forces. We call again on Russia and the forces that it arms, trains, and leads in the east to immediately observe the ceasefire. To comply with the Minsk agreements, those forces must withdraw all heavy weapons, disengage from the line of contact, and allow full, safe, and unfettered access to the OSCE monitors to the international border.
Meanwhile, the U.S. Treasury Department announced in Washington that it fined ExxonMobil $2 million for violating sanctions imposed on Russia in 2014, during the time that Rex Tillerson, now the U.S. Secretary of State, was the company's CEO. That announcement, issued by Treasury, said, quote, ExxonMobil demonstrated reckless disregard for U.S. sanctions requirements, closed quote. The Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control said ExxonMobil violated the sanctions when the presidents of its American subsidiaries did business with Igor Sechin, the president of Rosneft, OAO, and an individual whose assets were blocked under the sanctions. They said Exxon and Sechin and another person signed legal documents relating to oil and gas projects in Russia. Exxon said it had cleared the transactions through the Obama White House and Treasury, and that the transactions were not violations because they did not involve the personal assets of Sechin, who was sanctioned, but Rosneft's assets, and Rosneft was not sanctioned. That Thursday State Department press conference was a hotbed of reporters' questions about the announcement.
Just to get the legal stuff out of the way first, the secretary, when he became secretary, pledged to recuse himself from any kind of anything having to do with Exxon.
That's correct.
In the government. I presume that is the case with the Treasury, the OFAC announcement today. He had nothing.
That is correct. The State Department was not involved with the announcement from Treasury.
So correct. Not anyone, not even anyone lower. Consulted or was involved in this decision?
No, this was simply a Treasury action.
What does he think about this?
The secretary, we're not going to have any comments today for you on some of the alleged facts, the facts underlying the enforcement action. Treasury is going to have to answer a lot of these questions for you. I'm not going to have a lot for you on this today. The Treasury Department was involved in this. They were the ones who spearheaded this. And so for a lot of your questions, I'm going to have to refer you to Treasury.
Okay. Well, this is a question specifically related to him.
Yes.
And you're going to refer me to Treasury?
Well, Treasury has a lot of the details, but I'm beyond
this. I want to
know
what he thinks.
Yes. I'm not going to comment on that at this time. The secretary recused himself from his dealings with ExxonMobil at the time that he became Secretary of State. This all predates his time here at the Department of State, and so I'm going to refrain from giving any comment on that at this time.
I understand this predates his time at Secretary of State, but now he is in a position in which he is part of the team that is supposed to enforce sanctions, not violate them or allow others to violate them. So I think it's relevant to know what he thinks about this.
I think I will say this. The secretary continues to abide by his ethical commitments, including that recusal from Exxon-related activities. The action was taken by the Department of State, the Department of the Treasury, and State was not involved in this.
Right. Well, Exxon seems to, Exxon says in its statement that it thinks that it's being treated unfairly by OFAC and that it was led to believe that there was a difference between dealing with Mr. Sechin in a professional rather than a personal manner. In other words, that dealing with him professionally was okay, dealing with him personally was not.
The clearly, Office of Foreign Assets Control, that is under Treasury, so I can't comment on anything.
Clearly the Secretary, who was the CEO of Exxon at the time, would have known that. And in fact, OFAC in its ruling says that Exxon's senior most executives knew of such a status as an SDN when they went ahead and did these deals anyway. So that suggests, or doesn't suggest, it says that Exxon didn't think it, Exxon knew he was a sanctioned person, but didn't think that what it was doing was a violation. Does the Secretary still think that?
Matt, I hear your question. I'm not going to have any comment on the specifics that have come out of Treasury at this point. Exxon could perhaps best answer some of those questions, and Treasury can answer them as well.
Okay, your opening statement about Ukraine and the deteriorating situation there.
Correct.
The OFAC announcement says that ExxonMobil caused significant harm to the Ukraine-related sanctions program objectives by engaging in this, by signing not one, two, three, four, but eight different contracts, or its subsidiary did. Is the Secretary committed to the sanctions program and the objectives of the sanctions program?
I think the Secretary has been very clear not only about his support for the government of Ukraine, the support for the President, Mr. Poroshenko. I think that's incredibly evident by the fact that he just recently traveled over there. The Secretary had appointed Ambassador Kurt Volker to be a special envoy to handle Minsk and to handle the situation in eastern Ukraine. That's something that's extremely important to this building, this Secretary, Ambassador Volker as well.
Right.
And the overall administration. So I think our support of the Ukrainian government is clear. We had a good series of meetings as the President, Poroshenko, was here in Washington not that long ago, and then a really good series of meetings when they were in Kiev.
And all of what you just said is true, which makes it all the more surprising that something like this would happen. I mean, did he not support the objectives of the U.S. government when he was chairman of Exxon?
Can
you assure us that he does now?
I can't speak to that in particular. I can tell you additional questions. You can speak with ExxonMobil. They would best address them. The Secretary has recused himself. He's living up to his ethical commitments that he agreed to when he took this position as Secretary of State. I know some of these answers may not be satisfying to you, but that's what I can give you right now.
Can you tell us if the Secretary believes in the objectives of the Ukraine-related sanctions programs?
I know that we have remained very concerned about maintaining sanctions. That will continue. We've been clear that sanctions will continue until Russia does what Russia needs to do.
Right, he said that, but yes. I want to make. But he said that while he was in Ukraine, it was a very powerful statement,
We have no change in policy.
So you can assure us that he remains committed to the objectives of the sanctions program
pertaining to Ukraine. Yes, that is correct.
Okay.
That is correct. Okay, hold on. Hold on. Let's continue on this issue. If anybody has any questions, and we'll move on to something else. Carol. Well, I'm sorry.
Just for the record, will he come down and talk about this to us himself?
Well, I'm here to speak on his behalf, on behalf of the building. There's not a whole lot that we can say about this right now. Again, you can talk to Treasury or to Exxon about this.
In his confirmation hearing, under questioning, he was asked what he would do in situations where, I believe it was referring to an Iran deal that had been signed between an Exxon subsidiary. He was asked what he would do in a situation like that as Secretary of State, and he said, I would certainly be open to having the folks at the State Department contact companies and inquire as to whether they're aware of the actions that they're taking in the State Department's view. Hmm. So has Secretary of State been in touch with Exxon to caution them about their
actions? The Secretary
has
been, not to my knowledge, I can tell you this, that he has been extremely clear in his recusal of anything having to do with Exxon. When this information came to us here at the State Department, it did not come to the Secretary himself. It came to the Deputy Secretary, John Sullivan. The Secretary has taken this very seriously, that Exxon-related activities are not something that he is involved with here as Secretary of State.
So is the Deputy Secretary involved in some way? Is he communicating with Exxon, or does he plan to?
I don't know if he's communicating with Exxon. I just know that we were informed of that decision. I believe it came from the Treasury Department.
Was the Secretary aware that this guy was on the sanctions list and that he was signing it?
Carol, I can't answer that question for you right now.
Regarding the violence.
Okay. Hi.
Are there any new proposals the White House to provide more lethal aid to Ukraine? And does this violence that happened, you know, is that more under consideration now because of what's been happening?
I can't answer that for you at this point. I know that violence was concerning enough that it was brought to everyone's attention here. We had conversations about that. That's why I wanted to alert you all to it and underscore the importance and the level of concern that we have regarding that. Ambassador Kurt Volker will remain very engaged in the activities, trying to push both parties and also other countries who are involved in working on the Minsk Accords to try to get Russia to fulfill what we've asked them to fulfill. Okay. Hi.
Given that the Secretary Nixon violated these sanctions, is there any consideration that he would recuse himself?
I think that's an unfair way of phrasing it. You say that he did that. This involves the company, and that's why the company will have to speak to that.
And not the senior most executives in that company.
We don't know who was involved in that. At least I don't know who was involved in that at the time. Again, I'm not going to have a lot of information for you. Exxon could best answer that, or Treasury Department.
Hold on.
But go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, you know, just last week, the Secretary, speaking to two reporters who were lucky enough to be on his plane with him, said that his life as secretary is a lot different than being CEO of Exxon because, quote, I was the ultimate decision maker.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that if the company was aware that this guy, Mr. Sechin, was an SDN and decided to go ahead with the deals anyway because it thought that dealing with him professionally as opposed to personally was okay, that would go to the ultimate decision maker of the company.
Matt, I think that's a hypothetical type question. You're assuming that he was involved with that decision making. I don't know if that was the case or not.
The ultimate decision maker at Exxon, or
if
he wasn't.
If one says that one is the ultimate decision maker, that would be like me saying that in my household. I'm the ultimate decision maker, implying that other people in my family don't make decisions as well. You know that is the case, that people share.
Right, things. Well, saying the buck, yeah. I mean, in that interview, yeah. the idea was that
I'm not going to split hairs or parse words with what he said in that. I mean, it's obviously different being the CEO of a company than being the Secretary of State. I'm just going to leave it at that.
Basically saying there that the buck stops with him, and now you're sort of saying that, okay, well, this is not an
I'm
issue.
Just saying I don't have a whole lot for you on this. Treasury and Exxon can best answer your questions about it, okay?
Asked him for his personal thoughts on this, and he said that he doesn't want to say anything?
We have had these conversations, and it's been made very clear that this is something best for Exxon to handle. So I'm just going to leave it at that.
But as it relates to his current role as Secretary of State and his commitment to the sanctions program, the objectives of the sanctions programs, could someone please ask or have him come down here and tell us whether or not he's completely committed to them?
I think his visits and his meetings with President Poroshenko, he made those commitments extremely clear. The fact that one of the very first envoys that he appointed or asked to take on this role, I think it's notable that it was over the issue of Ukraine.
Right, which is why, again, I got to say, it's so surprising that he, as CEO of Exxon, would have countenanced or would have not been involved in a decision that to go ahead and do this kind of business, given the damage that Treasury says it caused to the sanctions regime objectives.
Okay.
Perhaps
Treasury can do. I want to finish Connor's question. Go right ahead.
No, that's okay. The first one, just is there any thought for the Secretary to recuse himself from any decision involving sanctions then?
Sanctions in general?
These Ukraine sanctions in particular, given that there was a violation.
The sanctions are in place. We are not backing away from those sanctions. Any subsequent conversations that may come down the pike, I'm not going to get ahead of what those might be.
So okay. He'll be involved in them?
I don't know. We haven't had that conversation just yet. Our focus today has been on the news that has come out of this. I'll keep you posted if I have anything for you on this, okay?
You said the Russian-led separatists in
yes.
Ukraine. So does that imply that, you know, there are Russian military advisors who are actually leading these forces in particular?
Like, it does. It does. We've talked about this, and I underscored this a few weeks back, that we believe that they are so-called separatists. They're not genuine separatists who are out there fighting on their own regard and their own behalf. These are Russian-led and Russian-backed.
So,
okay?
Just to clarify. The Russian military advisors.
I'm sorry?
The Russian military who are leading them.
Russian-led.
Okay.
Russian-advised. Yeah. Hi. Okay. And then we're going to move on. Michelle, take the
The technical side of this is with Treasury, and you're referring all of that to them. But as spokesperson for the State Department, can you say why the American public should trust that the secretary is committed to these sanctions on Russia when the company he led obviously did not take them seriously?
Michelle, I wouldn't go that far. This is early on in this process. We were just alerted to this yesterday. So this is all new. It's developing right now. Treasury will have more for you and perhaps Exxon as well. And I'm just going to...
The process is over.
Well, we're just all learning about it. We're all just learning about this.
His company, the company he led, violated the sanctions scheme. So how can the American people trust that he is committed to continuing with this?
I think he was very clear with President Poroshenko. The United States, this administration, the president have all been very clear about our support for the Ukrainian government, for its sovereignty and territorial integrity. And I'm going to leave it at that. Okay, let's move on.
A statement issued by ExxonMobil after the finding by the Office of Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC, read as follows. Quote, OFAC is trying to retroactively enforce a new interpretation of an executive order that is inconsistent with the explicit and unambiguous guidance from the White House and Treasury issued before the relevant conduct and still publicly available today. OFAC's action is fundamentally unfair. Closed quote. Meanwhile, the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee approved Thursday unanimously the nomination of Christopher Wray to be the FBI director. He would follow James Comey, who was dismissed by President Donald Trump. All 20 members of the committee voted to approve Wray, who's a former white-collar crime lawyer and a former assistant attorney general under President George W. Bush. Wray's nomination now goes to the full Senate for a vote. While the names of some of the countries that are targets of U.S. foreign policy are somewhat well-known to the U.S. audiences, other targets, like the Democratic Republic of Congo, remain largely out of view. Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford has more.
2 million people have been displaced by violence in the Kasai region of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Untold numbers have been killed, with many bodies found in mass graves. According to Kambale Musavuli of Friends of Congo, it's no coincidence that vast quantities of precious minerals have also been discovered in the Kasai region.
It's called 10 lithium and cobalt. And the media, unfortunately, of course, have been not connecting the displacement and the discovery of the minerals, because either is journalism dishonesty, may not know how to really explain why they're not covering that. But the reality is that for over a year now, people in the center of the Congo, the Kasai region, have suffered tremendously. We've now discovered 80 mass graves with bodies of people. So I'm not saying 80 people dead. I'm talking about 80 mass graves. A mass grave does not just have one or two bodies. We're talking about dozens of bodies in the mass grave. And these killings have been attributed in the latest report to some of the government forces clearly assaulting the civilians. And there are documentation of that, where earlier this year, a leaked video of the Congolese military shooting at civilians was released. The New York Times published the unedited version of the Congolese military filming how they were killing the civilians. So one will ask, why is the Congolese military shooting civilians, killing them, and actually filming themselves? Well, what people need to know is that this is something that the Congolese president has asked his military. And he has asked his military to film their military campaigns to actually prove that they are doing the work on the ground. So with the Kasai massacres that's taking place right now, it is important, really, for people to know this is not the first time this has happened in the Congo. The conflict in the Congo has taken the lives of 6 million people. And the same region that we are discussing about, we can go back 100 years from now. This is the same area where King Leopold II of Belgium caused the deaths of millions of Congolese again, in that same exact area. So 100 years ago, in that area, it was cop rubber they were getting. Now, 100 years later, is cobalt, lithium, and coltan they are getting. But the international press has gotten into the issue also because in the massacre that took place there, two young investigators from the UN were sent to actually come up with evidence that indeed in that area there are people who are being killed because they have been reporting of the mass graves. As these two young investigators went to the Kasai region in March of 2017, they were killed. One of them, Michael Sharp from Kansas, is working in Congo. His work actually also in Germany. He's done a lot of work around conflict resolutions. He's been really working also with Congolese communities before becoming a UN investigator. He was killed. He's an American. And the other person who was killed is Aida Catalan from Sweden. The two went there to put pressure on the UN in bringing up evidence about what was happening, and unfortunately they died. So there have been a lot of push around making sure that the truth comes out about who is responsible for the deaths and also the deaths of Congolese there. But as a human rights activist who has been following the situation in the Congo for a decade now, consistently, and with the evidence that has come out from RFE, it is clear that the deaths of civilians in the Kasai regions, hundreds of them, we have already found, we can say even thousands of them in these mass graves, have been caused by the Congolese government killing. And then the killing of Azaida Catalan and Michael Sharp, I could also claim the same, but we need an investigation actually into what has happened so that the people who have committed the crime could be found and could be brought to justice. So that's on one level. But the challenge now of the situation in Kasai, because it's happening in a context. It's happening in a context where there is a political impasse in the Congo where Joseph Kabila, who I can say today is the former president of the Congo, who has latched onto power beyond his term limit, has refused to organize presidential elections at the end of his second term. The way I could explain that is that, can you imagine the president of the United States, after his two terms, right? The U.S. president can only have two terms. After his second term, decides not to organize election and wait till after November of his second term, of the end of his second term to say, well, let's see what we can do about organizing another election. We still intend to run for a third term, when the U.S. Constitution doesn't say so. So this is the context in which that we are doing that.
Now, Kabila says that he's not trying to run for a third term, but there can't be elections until he holds a census to count how many Congolese there are and where they live, and that that census would take 18 months to organize and that he needs to stay there in the interim.
And this actually is preposterous. And he just did another interview with a German newspaper where they asked him the same question, and this was his response. He has never promised to the Congolese people that he will organize the elections. So what we are seeing with Kabila, the real issue of Kabila is to put the historical context of how long he's been in power. He's been in power for over 16 years, but we'll break it down. The first time he came into power, I call that a coup d'etat. Laurent Désiré Kabila was assassinated, and then he ascended to power. Congo had laws when the so-called son of the president, when the president died, the son of the president does not become the president. That's the reality in DRC, but somehow he became the president. So I call that a military coup d'etat, which was backed by the United States because the United States recognized him as the next president. Just as when there was a coup in Venezuela against Hugo Chavez, the U.S. was the first country to recognize that rogue government of power. The same thing happened with Joseph Kabila taking power in 2001. So from 2001 to 2006, he was the president of the so-called transition in the country. So I call that we gave him a free pass. Take that time, whatever you need to do, stay in power. In 2006, he organized an election, which at the end of the presidential election, Kabila was declared the winner. The international community has always presented it as he won it fair and square. But what I remember about 2006 is that Congolese people died in the street protesting the results. So 2006, he gets his first presidential term. The U.S. still sees him as an ally. And actually, the U.S. embassy organized a party for him in 2006. That's what people do not know. With the executives of Freeport-McMoRan, a U.S. Mining company. So we know that the U.S. wanted him to win that 2006 election. 5 years later, Congo's constitution said that the president has a five-year term limit. 5 years after that, the second election is organized, which if he won, he would be there for his last term. He was declared again the winner of the 2011 election. Massive protest inside and outside. The entire world knew that we had a sham election, that Kabila did not win that presidential election. So take a wild guess which country was the first country to recognize a fraudulent election. The United States was the first country to recognize Kabila as the president of the Congo on February 15, 2012. So the election took place in December of 2011, but it took them 2 months. And the entire so-called international community was waiting on the U.S. position because everyone was unclear. Would the United States support Kabila or not? Because Congolese were organizing and mobilizing to have people around the world not to recognize that those fraudulent elections. But the U.S. did. As soon as the U.S. recognized him, he received legitimacy around the world and Western nations continue to support him at the time. So from 2012 to 2016, Kabila wants the world to believe that he did not have the resources to organize presidential elections, that today, in 2017, months after the deadline of his presidency, that he needs more time to organize it. So what I will put forth is, if Kabila cannot organize presidential election in 5 years, he is not adequate to organize elections in 18 months. So he should step away. And that should not be even a discussion. The reason why I'm saying that should not be a discussion is the Congolese constitution is clear that the president of the Congo can only be president for two presidential terms and that the presidential term limits cannot be amended.
But the United States has now switched, apparently, on Mr. Kabila and is actively working to undermine him.
That is true that the United States government has definitely shifted policy on the Kabila regime. But we have to also put that in context. The U.S. is only looking for the interests of the United States government. While I'll applaud U.S. effort to challenge the Kabila regime on the arrest of young people, on the mistreatment of civilians, on asking him to step down, I'm very clear that Kabila will not have been here today if the U.S. did not support him in 2012, on February 15, 2012. So I'm clear about that position. But the effect of the U.S. switching side is that Kabila is actually playing, using it in his favor, in presenting himself as a so-called Pan-African leader, an African leader who's being attacked by the imperialists.
Yes, Kabila is now invoking the name of Patrice Lumumba every chance he gets.
And I'm sure wherever the soul of our hero, Patrice Lumumba, is, must be screaming that someone such as Kabila will even speak about Kimpavinta and other leaders of the Congo. But I'm very clear. And that's why the challenge of the narrative is what? Because it's not just about U.S. interest and also what Kabila government is doing. It is very important for African peoples and oppressed people around the world to be very clear about what's happening in the DRC, that the Congolese people are caught in a vicious circle whereby people who need Congo's resources are doing everything in their power for Congolese to not be free.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.